What a happy intro music. Hi, everybody. I'm Beatty Cohn-Vrados, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beatty Show. And for those of you who may be tuning in for the first time, even though the Ask Beatty Show has now been on the Progressive Radio Network for almost 6 years, it's like, where has the time actually gone? Well, I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, and I'm the author of For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And this is for people who are really serious about discovering the ingredients that really go into a healthy relationship so that we will never make a mistake in love again. I'm also a columnist, a national speaker, and I've been an expert guest in national radio and television now for many, many years. And I have a private practice here in beautiful and hot and rainy New York City and also in East Hampton. So what is the Ask Beatty Show really all about? Well, we talk about relationships, we talk about mental health and sexuality, and it's really a show about empowerment, because the reality is that we all go through so many ups and downs in our life. And it's so easy to become overwhelmed and discouraged and lonely and alienated. And yet the most important things that we have to really ask ourselves every single day is, what are we going to do? What are some of the steps that we can take with help, without help, whether or not we're lucky enough to have family and friends who at times, during difficult times, can really take us by the hand and give us that extra bit of support that we all need in order to be able to really acknowledge and address and hopefully resolve as best as we can the issues that are really getting in the way of our lives and of our relationships. And this is not an easy thing to do. I mean, we all have crises. We all have traumas of various different kinds. And it takes a lot of strength. It really takes a lot of strength to be able to navigate all of life's ups and downs. And yet, really, what are our choices? You know, for example, if we're looking at depression statistics in this country, 17 million adults in the United States suffer from depression. And really, half of all Americans, and this is a study that I really actually question, are now being encouraged to seek help for depression. 40 million Americans are suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. And of course, if we're looking at the world of relationships, and I talk a lot about relationships, 4 women are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. Teenage dating abuse. 1 in 3 teenagers are citing that their relationships at different times are abusive, and 30% of college co-eds are also citing relationships that are fraught with verbal abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. So there are a lot of things that we actually have to learn. And I think that learning about life and life's ups and downs and relationships, it really is a learning curve for all of us. And of course, if we're looking at the divorce statistics, and somebody was saying to me yesterday that she was very surprised when I was citing the divorce statistics to her for first marriages, 48% of couples marrying for the first time, their marriages end in divorce. 67% of second marriages also end in divorce, and 74% of third marriages too end up in a divorce court. So if we're looking at relationships, and I talk about this a lot, and I give seminars here in New York City and around the country, my seminars are Never Make a Mistake in Love Again. In fact, I'm going to be doing a major presentation at the East Hampton Library, and you're going to be able to actually Google Beattie Cohn East Hampton Library, and you will be able to participate in my workshop on Tuesday, June the 29th at 6 p.m. And it is free, so there are no reasons at all why you cannot Zoom in and listen to my Never Make a Mistake and Love Again presentation. But people are always wondering, so what are the things that we actually have to do to educate ourselves and empower ourselves and above all keep us safe in our relationships? Well, very quickly, I am just going to summarize my Never Make a Mistake and Love Again program. The first thing is that each of us does need to be in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically, and we have to be willing and we have to be honest and we have to be serious to deal with our own issues. And as I used to tell my daughter Jordana when she was a little girl, the relationship needs to be the icing on the cake, and we need to be the cake. We need to be the foundation. We need to be strong. We need to be feeling good about ourselves so that the relationship will enhance our lives. You know, so many people who are not feeling good about themselves, who are lonely, who are depressed, are anxious, are really hoping that Prince Charming or Princess Charming is going to come along and make everything okay. But unfortunately, that's really a fantasy. So that if it's depression or anxiety or early child sexual abuse or any kinds of traumas that you currently are experiencing or that you have experienced in your life, including addictions of all kinds, it is your responsibility to you to try to take care of your skeletons in the closet and your unfinished business as best as possible. Because unless we do this, what ends up happening is that we live our lives basically with one foot in the past and one foot in the present. So we need to feel good about ourselves. We need to feel strong. And over and above that, that is when we project the most attractive version of ourselves, when we are in a really good place. So if you have some work to do, and of course the fact is that we all have work to do on ourselves, I'm hoping that over the last number of years, and of course today, all we really do have is today, that I have convinced you to take whatever steps are necessary, including some therapy, to make sure that you are living your life in the best possible way. So that's number one. And of course, number two, and I wish we all had these relationship education classes when we were in school, probably even in elementary school, to basically learn the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship. And you know, you'd be surprised with all the talk about relationships and all of the coaches and therapists and relationship movies and shows. I mean, the statistics are telling us that we are tanking, that we are not doing well. And what I have found is that unless we do our own work, unless we do have clarity about the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship, and then, of course, my formula, and I talk about this all the time, based on my research, on my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, and, of course, to over 35 years of clinical experience. I mean, I've treated thousands and thousands of people from every walk of life. And what I have found is that, you know, we spend a lot of time assessing what mortgages we should buy and what cars and computers and cameras and makeup. And yet when it comes to relationships, we don't tend to think about relationships in the same kind of way, and how important it is that we do very careful and very in-depth assessments, and we decide who we are going to allow into our lives. And my 10-step formula, which in my personal life, I'm probably one of the most impatient people that you would ever want to meet. But professionally, of course, that's a different thing. My research found is that it takes about a year to really find out who somebody is and who somebody is not, and you cannot fast forward the process, unless, of course, there are many, many red flags that you are seeing early on, abuse of various different kinds, somebody who doesn't want to talk to you, somebody who is a narcissist, somebody who is blaming you, somebody who has a variety of different kinds of substance abuse problems. And the one thing that we really have to acknowledge is that we cannot change anybody at all. And a lot of people believe if I only loved him more, if I only cared for her more, that somehow I am going to be able to transform and change the relationship. And of course, the fact is, the reality is that the only person that we can possibly ever change is ourselves. So that if you are really serious about wanting to find and maintain a healthy relationship, I really, really suggest that you go to the internet, that you can purchase my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love on Amazon. And if you do, if you're happening to be free on Tuesday, June the 29th, you can Zoom in and you can listen to my Never Make a Mistake in Love Again presentation that I'm going to be giving at the East Hampton Library. And it'll be interesting. And it's always interesting to hear your reactions to all of this. Because for me, I'm a very bottom line kind of a person. If something is not working, then let us not waste our time talking about things and writing about things that are not going to help us improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. And I think that these days, you know, mental health is really in the forefront in the media. I mean, there's more and more and more talk about therapy and mental health. And, you know, it's so interesting. And I know this is a couple of weeks ago that I was talking about the new reality that there's going to be more and more therapy, actual psychotherapy, that's going to be offered at drugstores around the country. I know that CVS, they are one of the largest retail pharmacies in the United States. And they are envisioning that they're going to be clinical social workers, and I assume psychologists, who are going to be trained and who are going to be available. So just imagine you're going to CVS or you're going to Walmart or Walgreens and you're having a bad day. You may be going to the drugstore to get a prescription, or you may be going to the drugstore to buy a lipstick or some nail polish. But you're down. You're lonely. You haven't had anybody that you can talk to in maybe days or weeks, and for some people, even months. And here you are going to have an opportunity to go in and to be able to sit down and talk to someone, because what we are needing more and more and more these days is connection and a sense of community. And whether or not you're able to get the community in a synagogue environment or church environment or a sports environment, the environments as such are really not what's important. What is important is that we do not allow ourselves to remain alone and isolated And those are sure ways that people can become very, very depressed, including suicidal. And another thing that has become just really kind of amazing is all of the different therapy apps. I was reading a piece in the New York Times, the title, Tell It to Wobot. And so here you have an app. So when your therapist is an app, you can reach it at 2 a.m. But the question, of course, is will it really understand your problems or human connection? And I mean, what's incredible is that more and more and more people, because of technology, are actually going to apps. Now, with this Wobot, it was founded by a psychologist, Allison Darcy. And Wobot Health says that the pandemic has driven up demand for its services. The number of its daily users doubled and is now in the tens of thousands. I mean, that is incredible. When you're talking about algorithms and you're talking about artificial intelligence, so apparently, digital mental health has become a multi-billion dollar industry and includes more than 10,000 apps. I was really surprised to read this, according to an estimate by the American Psychiatric Society. But Wobot, which was introduced in 2017, is one of only a handful of apps that use artificial intelligence to deploy the principles, and this is a type of therapy, of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a common technique used to treat anxiety and depression. So, of course, at issue is the nature of therapy itself. Can therapy by bot make people understand themselves better? Can it change long-held patterns of behavior through a series of probing questions and reflective exercises? And I mean, this is really, really the question. I mean, I don't know about you, and maybe this is because I've been a psychotherapist and a sex therapist for, you know, so many years. I mean, over 35 years. I could not even imagine using technology in this way if I was wanting and needing to have a therapy series of sessions with a qualified psychotherapist. And yet, you know, as we see on television, there are more and more companies that have gotten into the online therapy business. And I know that for myself, up until 2 weeks ago, I was seeing all of my patients on Zoom as a result of the pandemic. I mean, we didn't have any options at all. And although it worked fairly well, all I can tell you is that there is a vast difference, and I think that my patients would all agree, between seeing somebody and experiencing a therapeutic relationship, both with the therapist and for the patient on Zoom, versus being able to come into an office and see somebody face to face. There's body language. There are all kinds of things that happen in a face to face interaction that I found did not happen with Zoom. Of course, I'm still offering, you know, Zoom sessions for people who I am treating out of state. But I think that there is no substitute for that human, personal, face-to-face connection, at least in the world of psychotherapy.
But if we're looking at our lives and our relationships and the new normal since pandemic, although I must say that in New York and walking around the streets, about 50% of the people that I see are still wearing masks. So we're still a little bit leery. I wear my mask on my wrist just to make sure that if I'm going into a store that I'm going to feel protected. And of course, there are signs all over that are still required. Mandatory, wearing of masks, but we're emerging. We are emerging into a new season, and there's been a lot of disruption. And yet again, what I found is that crises, whether or not we're talking about pandemics or crises of various different kinds, are sometimes the very, very best things that can help us reflect and reset and really evaluate where we are in our lives and in our relationships. Because these days you can hardly pick up a newspaper, magazine, or of course going to the computer or watch a television show that does not address the subject of health and fitness and beauty in one way or another. And advertisements, I mean, they go on and on. They promise us youthful skin if only we use a particular cream. And we're obsessed. We are obsessed about the importance, or at least we talk about the importance of eating well and exercising regularly. And yet Americans are the most overweight people in the world. So we talk the talk a lot, but we do not walk the walk. And, you know, we're cognizant of the evils. And Dr. Gary Null, he talks about this every single day of excess, be it food or alcohol or other vices. And yet we continue to ignore the warnings. And we're told, I mean, Madison Avenue, they do a great job in selling us all kinds of things. We're told how a new nose or facelift or breast reduction or augmentation, will change our lives forever. But the reality is that only on occasion, and I ask you to do this every single week, we are asked to seriously evaluate the quality and health or lack of our personal relationships and our own lifestyle, because we all know that too much fat can kill us. But how many of you think about this? And of course, I think about this every single day because I see so many people who are in really, really toxic relationships. So how many people are aware of the long-term effects emotionally and physically and medically of surrounding ourselves with loving, stable, and satisfying interpersonal relationships? And conversely, how many of us realize that toxic people and toxic relationships can literally kill us? So that the exercise that I am asking you to participate in right this moment is to really evaluate the relationships that you currently have in your life with your partner, your children, your grandchildren, your friends, your business associates. And if you look at these relationships really, really honestly, how do you rate them on a scale of goodness and health? And if your relationships, if you were finding that one or some or all of your relationships are relationships that are really not in your best interest, of course, the real question is, what are you planning to do about it? And I know that it's scary. It's really scary to have difficult conversations. None of us like conflict. of any kind. And yet, if you're wanting to have a good relationship with anyone, it's so important. It's so important that when things start to get off track, that you give yourself permission to have a conversation and say something like, you know, I'm really upset with what you just said, or I'm really upset with what you just did. And I love you and I care about you, but this kind of behavior is very painful for me. And of course, the most important thing that you want to find out is whether or not this person cares enough about you and cares enough about the relationship to be willing to do some serious introspection and to be able to say, listen, I'm really sorry the way I talked to you. I'm really sorry the way that I have been treating you. And then virtually any relationship then can hopefully move forward and improve. And this is why, you know, when people ask me all the time, what are the two most important ingredients that really make or break relationships? It's not money and it's not sex, but it happens to be emotional communication and problem solving. And this is something in my 10-step formula that I talk about a lot, is that when we are assessing to see whether this person is really someone that's good for us, or whether or not this is somebody who is going to make us crazy ultimately, we need to find out whether or not a person who we're interested in or attracted to, or we think that we want a relationship with, is really capable of sitting down and having real conversations, not so much about where are we going to go for dinner, but tackling the tough issues. And this is something that I would say that the majority of people have simply not learned the emotional communication and problem solving skills necessary to maintain and sustain healthy relationships. I want to tell you about a case that I am currently working with a woman. And of course, I'm going to be changing some of the demographics and the names to protect her confidentiality. Let's call her Sharon. Sharon is a gorgeous, gorgeous professional woman who is married to Brian. Of course, that's not his real name. And Sharon is also not her real name, who's a very successful man. And this is a second marriage for both of them. So Sharon recently was hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital after taking an overdose of prescription medication. Her psychiatrist referred her to me for counseling. And when you look at Sharon and her handsome husband and their extravagant lifestyle, many would wonder what would drive a woman who seemingly had everything to the point of wanting to kill herself. And by the way, let me tell you that nobody ever really knows what goes on behind closed doors. So in the beginning of my individual therapy with Sharon, I learned a lot of things, and over and above cognitive behavioral therapy techniques, when I do therapy, I start at the beginning. I want to go back to a person's family of origin. I want to know what they learned, what they didn't learn about healthy relationships. I want to know what their experience was in terms of relating to their parents and their siblings. Because unless, and this is what I found, unless you really are able to get to the root of people's problems, we are continuing to just put bandages on infections. And that's why it's all fine and well to be talking about today and what we do need to do today to improve our lives. To understand today, we always need to go back to yesterday. So in the case of Sharon, I wanted to know about her family of origin and what went on that would explain that she only has been in physically and verbally and emotionally and sexually abusive relationships. It just didn't make sense to start with today, but I needed to know, where did she learn somehow that abusive relationships were the norm? So Sharon, what happened with her, she was married a couple of times, she physically changed husbands, but in fact, the dynamics between husband number one and husband number two were almost identical. And that was something that was interesting for me to learn about Sharon. And it was also, in fact, something really, really important for her to realize because, you know, initially she said, well, the two men were completely different. Well, they were not at all completely different. In fact, they were basically identical. So what were the characteristics of these men? Well, they were considered pillars of society. And no one looking at Sharon and her husbands would ever dream how she was beaten, how she was raped, and how she was demeaned in both of her marriages. And when I asked her about her family, I said, you know, what was it like? What was it like growing up in your family? She initially told me that her father and mother were wonderful, but I needed to explore further because it didn't make sense to me that if everything was so wonderful, if she had such a great relationship with her family, and if her parents' marriage was as terrific as she had initially told me, then what would explain that Sharon continued to find herself in really domestic violent relationships? So we continued to get to know each other, and it was only after a few sessions that I learned the truth about Sharon's family of origin, that her father on occasion would hit her, and that he would also hit her mom. And that she told me that her father was an alcoholic and he had a string of affairs during her childhood and would even bring his girlfriends to their home to have sex. And Sharon's mom, and she realized this in retrospect, had suffered from a lot of depression and anxiety. Of course, no surprise if you were living with a man who was hurting you and in every possible way in having extramarital affairs. I mean, how could somebody not feel depressed and anxious? So what did Sharon learn? What did she learn about abuse? Well, she learned that abuse was a normal part of life. In fact, it shocked her to realize that both of her husbands even resembled her father physically. And that is why if people are serious about getting serious, serious therapy, you really do have to go back to the beginning and make the links and understand the links, even though we cannot change our history. So Sharon was in therapy with me for over 6 months. We were meeting sometimes even twice a week. So she was in therapy. She was still taking some antidepressant medication, which after the 6 months of therapy, she was actually able to get off. And Sharon is a new woman. She is assertive with her family, her colleagues, and her husband. And she's feeling good about herself and her accomplishments, probably for the first time in her life. Her confusion about what kind of behavior is okay and what behavior must never be tolerated is finally resolved. So she learned through our therapy that even though abuse was a normal part of her life, that it must never, never, never again be a part of her life again. So her next goal, and this is something that she, is wanting and is willing to tackle, is to begin marital therapy in hopes of resolving the marital issues. Now, I just want to say something, is that if her husband were to continue to hurt her physically, verbally, sexually, or emotionally, it would not be in Sharon's best interest to begin marital therapy with someone who is violent and who is abusive. And this is something that therapists really need to be careful about. And patients also need to be aware of that you must never, it is wrong, it is unethical to be putting a perpetrator in the same room as a victim. The power dimensions are just not fair. And unless the abuse, the actual abuse stopped, and the people were both looking to figure out how to improve the quality of their relationship, it would not be a good thing at all to begin marital therapy. And what was interesting over the 6 months that I was meeting with Sharon individually is that she became more assertive, and the dynamics between her and her husband actually started to change. And I was really looking forward to meeting him and seeing whether or not he was really, really sorry for the years of abuse that he heaped on his wife. But I think the good news is that Sharon now knows what she will and will not accept from her husband. She realizes now that she will no longer live her life on a roller coaster, never knowing whether she will be getting the carrot or the stick. And although she claims to love her husband, she now loves herself for the first time in her life and is prepared. And she's told me this on multiple occasions, to divorce him if he does not learn to treat her with love and respect. And of course, physically, there's also some really good news as a result of her individual therapy. Her migraine headaches have disappeared. She now sleeps through the night, and her irritable bowel syndrome is under control without medication. And that is what happens in really, really good therapy, when somebody is really able to come into their own. Well, we are going to change. We're going to change direction right now. And I have a guest. And my guest is Jerome Gold, who is the author of A Love Story. Jerome, welcome to the Ask Beattie Show. Hi, Jerome, are you there, I hope?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh. Yes, I can. Welcome. And I want to tell you that I absolutely loved your book, The Love Story. And I want people to know that you were the author of 17 books. I barely was able to complete my first book. 17 books. I mean, that's a lot of writing.
Well, I've been doing it for a long time. I've been writing, or at least I've started publishing back in the 80s. So if you, a dogged does it, as Darwin used to say, you just keep at it.
Well, for sure. And you've certainly been keeping at it. Well, I just want people to know a little bit about your background, that you saw combat during the American War in Vietnam, and that you were on active duty during Desert Shield, the prelude to the first American war in the Persian Gulf. And that since your return from Vietnam, your literacy preoccupations have been of an existential nature, and that you have been especially interested in the relationship of individuals to larger forces and social and historical. And what I found really interesting too is that you have a master's degree in anthropology from the University of Montana
and a doctorate in anthropology from the University of Washington. And what I, of course, found really, really interesting is that you chose not to pursue a career in academia, but instead worked as a rehabilitation counselor in prisons for children in Washington State. So how did that happen? I mean, that was a big, big switch from your training and from your educational background.
It was a switch in that I applied for the job. I was on active duty for Desert Shield, and a friend of mine who was also on active duty for Desert Shield, asked me what I was going to do when the war was over. And I didn't know. I had a vague plan to go on unemployment for a while so I would have time to write. But he encouraged me to go out to the place where he worked and apply. That they weren't hiring at the moment, but in a few months they would be, and I'd be on their list. So in February of 91, I went out there. And 2 days later, I was called in, or I didn't go out there, I called. And 2 days later, I was called in for an interview. And then a few days after that, I was hired full time. So that was kind of a shock. I wasn't expecting that. But I found out that the person who interviewed me, her name is Mary, the reason she hired me is she liked people who had overseas experience. She looked at the, I'm sorry?
No, I was going to ask you whether or not the characters in your book, A Love Story, was the book written before you worked in this rehabilitation center or after?
After.
After. So yeah. Was there something about the work that got you to a place where you decided to write a book about Bob and Jen, high school seniors and sweethearts at the end of the Eisenhower era? And I mean, I really, really, I loved the writing, Jerome. And I was just wondering how and where did this book come from? I mean, what prompted you to write it, and whether or not it was because in part of the work that you were doing at the Rehabilitation Center for Children?
I think unconsciously it was heavily influenced by the work I did there. I mean, I listened to your opening remarks today, and everything you do with adults, I did with children, except mm-hmm. I saw them every day. I didn't have a counseling session with all of them every day. But I did have a counseling session with those on my caseload, at least, every week. But I also saw them monitor their behavior as a prison every day, at least 5 days a week. So I got to know some of them very, very well. I would have some of them on my caseload for years at a time, depending on, you know, they're all convicted felons. So depending on the crime, that would determine how long to be in prison. When I left the prison, I retired early to have more time to write. I wrote three books about my experiences there. All three were memoirs. But I wanted to go back. I wanted to write a novel, and I wanted to write about people who had not been in prison. And then somebody I had known when I was very young, when we were very young, called. I had not heard from her in over 35 years, and she had recently had recently recovered from a bout with cancer, and was thinking about her life, and she wanted to talk with somebody who had known her when, as she put it, known her when I was full of myself, when she was full of herself. And so as we talked, we had a series of telephone conversations and even more emailings back and forth. We lived in different states. So as we talked, I began making notes in my journal. But within just a few days, her character was changing. Her personality was changing, in my journal, that is. And she was becoming somebody else. And also my relationship with her was becoming something different, too. I was fictionalizing it because it was more fun to fictionalize it. And it became, without realizing it, it became this book. But as far as learning about people, generally speaking, and applying all that, to applying what I learned to the book, that's definitely happened. There was a point you made that I have thought about a lot for several years. To put it in my own words, is that we tend to repeat ourselves in our relationships.
Right.
And as the book opens, as my book opens, Bob, the main character, I focus on his family life, and it's not a happy life. But there are just a few hints that his father did not have a happy family life either. And the relationship of his father with his own family, and then Bob with his father particularly, has been repeated. Somebody not following the prose carefully might miss that. Now, that doesn't matter. But it was a way for me to think about what was going on. And then the same thing with Jen, her devotion to her father, and then her mother's devotion, not specifically to her father, but to her own natal family, that keeps being that's repeated again. And so physical attraction aside, or sexual attraction aside, which Bob and Jen have for each other, the way that they know to behave is what they've observed. And they're both very young. When the book opens, they're only 17 years old.
You know, it's interesting. It's very interesting, you know, Jerome, because I found Bob, at least at the beginning of the book, and I really, really suggest strongly that people buy the book, A Love Story, and that you're not going to be able to put it down, just like I had difficulties putting it down. I found Bob initially to be kind and loving and considerate, and that he was a really good boyfriend. Jen, on the other hand, I had a lot more trouble with Jen and her game playing. And, you know, the example, of course, that you wrote so vividly about, you know, when they were driving in a car and she would put her hand over his eyes and, you know, putting really both of them at risk. I liked Bob a lot more than I liked Jen. And I don't know how you felt about the characters when you were writing about them. And then, of course, things changed over the years.
Yeah.
When they were together and then when they broke up.
Well, remember, too, early in the book, there are indications that there's something violent inside Bob, and he's suppressing it.
Right.
Remember when he was picked up by, when he was hitchhiking, and these fraternity boys stopped pretending to want to pick him up?
Yes.
And his response to that.
Yes.
And, yeah, so that's there. And remember, too, that his father had hit him. And he,
right.
Or before that. So that's there too. And then, I was fascinated by both. I was especially fascinated by Jen. I don't know why, really. I think just the way her character just kind of evolved. I didn't realize I knew so much, about teenage girls. Teenage boys I took for granted because I was one. But somewhere, I think probably because of my work out at the prison, I learned a lot about teenage girls. And I did some treatment groups, and I used to discuss domestic abuse and violence. I remember some of the groups were co-ed, and I remember in one of the co-ed groups, I was talking about domestic violence. And I talked about a friend of mine who had done her her master's thesis on domestic violence. Her discovery was that she was dealing with adults. Her discovery was that some women will goad men into hitting them because immediately following that, the man is so remorseful and the woman has control over him for a very short time. Of course, these women don't understand that ultimately, they're putting their lives at risk. And I mentioned that, and two of the girls in this group said, and these were, I think one was 16, one was 17. Both of them said at the same time, I do that, talking about their relationships with their own boyfriends. I'm not saying that this is the common thing. I don't think it is the common thing. And yet it's happened, and girls and women, too, should watch out about what they're doing. I'm not trying to say that men are not responsible. They're responsible for their own behavior. But women could be stepping into a trap without even realizing it.
Well, I think that, you know, the majority of people, unfortunately, have learned very, very little about healthy relationships. I mean, it's something that has never been a priority in our educational system at all. It still is not. And basically, I mean, we really are left to our own devices to figure this out. And the statistics, I mean, if you were with me at the beginning of the show, I mean, the statistics are soaring. It's not like things are getting better in the world of divorce or domestic violence or teenage dating abuse or college co-ed dating abuse. And, you know, this is sort of the sad reality is that the destructive and self-destructive patterns are really just continuing, despite the fact, you know, which is so interesting, is that mental health and relationships are now in the forefront in the media. And yet, yeah. it's not playing out in a positive way in the real world.
I agree with you. I agree with you entirely. I did this one treatment group called Alternatives to Violence, and it started off as an 8-week course once a week, and by the time I finally gave it up, it was 16 weeks long, and I wasn't finished with it yet.
I wanted to ask you something. In the last chapter of your book, and I was rereading it again last night, did you... leave us wondering whether or not Jen and Bob were going to get back together again after so many years of detours?
Well, I did, but to me that wasn't the most important aspect of the last chapter. What I was trying to show in the last chapter was that in spite of everything, in spite of ourselves, in spite of the world, in spite of everything, once we have loved another person, that love does not go away. Other things can interfere with it. They can get on top of it. They can obscure it, but it doesn't go away. It endures.
Mm-hmm. And you felt that it endured with Bob and Jen. Because I loved, I mean, all the questions, that you posed in that last question. They were very poignant questions, and I wondered. I mean, did you want them to get back together? I mean, they were both divorced and available in some fashion. Was that the hope that they were going to find their way back together in a healthier and better way, and fall in love all over again?
Well, you always hope for that in both in fiction and in real life. I don't think that happens a lot. I think we're more often trapped by our own past, by the emotional rut we're in. But I wanted to present it as a possibility in the book. I wanted to present it as a possibility that they could, or they might not. Uh-huh. But even if they didn't, they still loved each other and they knew it. They may not have known it a year before, but by talking together again, they knew it.
Mm-hmm. So we were left with the real question mark of what was going to happen. But on a very personal note, Jerome, I had a very similar situation happen to me when I was 20 years old. I'm Canadian. I was in New York and I was dating Jim, and we dated for about a year. And then we went our separate ways without any contact at all for almost, well, for our entire adult life. And literally out of the blue, about 7 years ago, I was living in Sarasota, Florida. I received an email from Jim. And it was like, really? It's been a lifetime. And I was coming to New York to do a television show. And we reconnected. And after all those years, and you're so right in what you're saying, there was something there. And we got married 5 years ago. And I feel like I'm the luckiest girl in the world to have been given an opportunity to go back to my early relationship years. And I loved him when I was 20 years old, and to be able to have another chance at love with my first love. So that really, it really resonated with me. And that was one of the other reasons why I loved your book so much.
You know, that story, actually, and I hadn't even thought about how this may have influenced the book. My marriage is similar. We dated. She was a freshman in high school. I was a junior. So, I was the first boy she dated in high school. We went out a few times and then drifted apart. And, 15 years ago, we got married.
You know, it's amazing, isn't it? And, you know, how we connect and whether or not there's some life force, and I'm probably not one of the most spiritual people in the world. And yet my husband, Jim, who's a sociologist and an activist, he is not a techie. And the fact that he was able to find me, I mean, he didn't even know my last name. He didn't know what I did. And I suppose thanks to technology, he was able to, get my email address. So, you know, there are more things. What was the quote? There are more things on earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in our imagination. And I suppose your story and my story, I mean, I feel very grateful that I was given another chance with somebody who I loved so many years ago.
So do I. I think so. So do my wife. My wife and I both. I might add something to what you had said earlier before we started talking about successful relationships. I would say a sense of humor.
Absolutely.
My wife makes me laugh every day, and I make her laugh as often as I know how.
You're so right, and that is something in me that I need to improve. My husband has an amazing sense of humor, and I tend to be a lot more serious, especially, you know, when serious things are going on. So that's something that I'm actually really trying to work on. Listen, Jerome, I'm looking at the clock. I can't believe that this time has come and gone, and we really need to stay in touch. And again, I absolutely loved your book. A love story, and people can get it on Amazon. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the actual title is Sex, comma, A Love Story.
Ah, because I'm looking at the cover. Oh, yes, right. Absolutely. Sex, A Love Story. Yes. Beautiful book, beautiful cover, beautiful man. Thank you so much. And take good care, and let's stay in touch, okay?
Thank you, Bidia. I appreciate
it. Okay, take care. Bye-bye. Well, that was Jerome Gold, Sex, A Love Story. And it really is amazing how the time comes and goes when you're having a good time. And, you know, I leave you every week with my two weekly messages, which I really do hope that you, you know, seriously take in. And the first is that we all need to do everything that we could possibly do, including therapy if need be, to love ourselves and do what is in our best interest. To think about it as we go through our days. Is this good for me or is this bad for me? And if we find that we're off track, then we have to be mindful of getting ourselves back on track. And of course, we also all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other. So goodbye, everybody. Have a good rest of the day and week. And I will talk with you next week and every Monday from 3 to 4 live Eastern Standard Time right here on the Ask Beattie Show on the Progressive Radio Network. So goodbye, everybody.